Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey there, everybody. Welcome to Rough Draft. I am your host, Reza Aslan. We have a very special episode of Rough Draft today. We have not one guest, but two guests, Christopher Marcus and Stephen McFeely, the writing duo that brought us literally the biggest movie in the world, Avengers Endgame. Of course, they also wrote Infinity War. In fact, they've been with Marvel for quite some time now. They wrote all of the Captain America movies, including my favorite Marvel movie, Civil War. That's, I think, really the height of the Marvel experience is Captain America Civil War. But nevertheless, these two have been together for a very, very long time. In fact, they met in writing school. They've only ever written together. Their first attempt at co-writing was a never-made episode of Baywatch, which I don't want to give too much away, but let's just say that had this episode actually been made, it would have been Emmy-worthy TV right there. Obviously, the main reason that I wanted to talk to Marcus and McFeely had to do with the fact that they are at the height of the superhero genre, this genre that has completely taken over. In fact, we're going to have a bit of a testy exchange about what it means to have superheroes become sort of the primary mythology of our world now. And for those of you maybe unfamiliar with this term myth, mythology, look it up in a dictionary, people, because it doesn't mean what you think it means. It does not mean false story. On the contrary, myth literally means stories of gods and goddesses. And of course, the truths that myths convey have very little to do with the actual facts of the story. Those truths are much, much deeper. But I make this argument to Marcus and McFeely that the superhero genre has become so popular, not just because of the spectacle and all that stuff, but because it has become the new myth for the way that we understand the world. And look, I'm not the first person to bring this up, obviously, but I am someone who actually is going to go to the mat about it and fight with Marcus and McFeely about whether they are creating our new gods. In fact, we play a little game in this episode of Rough Draft called God or Superhero, which I think you're going to really love. I describe a being, and Marcus and McFeely have to tell me whether I'm describing a god or a superhero, and I will tell you they did not do a very good job on this game. We'll see how you do when you play it. But the main reason I wanted to talk to Marcus and McFeely has to do with the idea of collaboration. Listen, I don't need to tell you this. A lot of writers know this already. Writing is a solitary enterprise, right? There are people who believe that creativity by committee just simply doesn't work. It's actually why so much of television is just pure shit, because that creative process has to go through committee after committee and just get watered down and compromised. And yet, here is a collaborative writing duo, Marcus and McFeely, who have managed to make this work for their entire career. And so we talk a lot about what is the key to making collaboration work. How do you deal with each other's strengths and weaknesses? What happens when you have a disagreement? Can there actually be creativity by committee? And in the case of working in Marvel, it's not just the writers. I mean, you have to figure out a way to connect your work to dozens of movies that come before you and dozens that are planned ahead of you. How do you do that? For those of you out there who don't write alone, who write with a writing partner, this episode is especially for you. And for those of you out there who are not writers, but who are just, you know, comic book geeks, this episode is especially for you. So without further ado, here's my conversation with Stephen McFeely and Christopher Marcus.
Can Can we just begin just by acknowledging for a minute how big of a fucking deal it is that you guys have written literally the biggest movie in the history of the world. Let's just start there, shall we? Yeah, I mean, that's a big deal. That is a big deal. We don't want to like just like race past that, you know?
Unadjusted for inflation.
Sure. We'll find a way to undercut this.
Don't do that. No. But this is the important thing that I think that I want to talk about and why I was so excited to have you guys on the show, because the reason it's the biggest movie has to do with the writing. The writing is the core of it. It begins with words on the page, right? It's not just because of the spectacle or the effects. I mean, Justice League had spectacle and effects, if you know what I mean.
We're not here.
We're not here to shit on DC. Right. I'm just saying.
Yes.
I'm just saying.
It starts with the words. It starts with the words of 21 other movies, too.
Yeah, that's an important thing. And it begins with this notion that this, like, the complexity, right, of using dialogue to reveal character.
Yeah.
And to reveal three-dimensional characters, and that's no small feat, and I just want to congratulate both of you for that.
Thank you, sir.
It's really, really wonderful to be here. Let's talk about this decade. It's been, I guess, 10 years since the
first it's 11 Avengers? Since we first walked in the door for the meeting.
Yeah? And how do you, when you kind of look back on that decade, what do you see? How do you feel? Is it just a blur?
It's like one long job in a way, and so it's a little blurry. It's weird in that we got on the ground floor essentially of what became sort of the go-to sort of cornerstone for blockbuster filmmaking.
Yeah. Like, we weren't planning on capturing the zeitgeist.
Yeah.
We just needed a
that was
job,
like a life's goal.
It's weird, but I mean, to the point where other than the story of the last 10 years, in many ways is Netflix and Marvel, right? And what they have done to Hollywood. And so it's weird and kind of, it's...
You say done to, like...
It does,
like
it seems like it, I know.
Yes,
that's right.
Well,
that's
what they had on which side of Hollywood you're on.
That's right.
Out of the goodness of their heart.
Yeah, that's right. But I mean, I get that, like, at first, like you said, look, we're looking for a job and we're excited to be a part of this, and we'll talk about how that all started. But when you get to the end of this road and you're sitting here writing these last two movies, you must have had some idea. Was there some expectation of what was about to happen?
I think we had an expectation of how much we had to do.
Mm-hmm. Well, it is a 17-hour movie, right?
It is a 17-hour film.
17-hour.
Showa. Yeah. Slightly shorter.
Yeah.
And more upwind.
There was a nap in the middle. I remember my movie theater.
Really?
Like,
is that really?
They gave us like a 90-minute nap halfway through. Yeah, just so we could make it to the end.
Yeah. We knew it was going to be big a large thing, like a massive undertaking.
Sure, yeah.
But it wasn't also, and no, it doesn't seem to people like it was a risk, but it was. The second Avengers had not made as much as the first Avengers. You know, there are some people who believe there's a law of diminishing returns when you make sequels, which these aren't.
Right.
But,
no.
So taking on two of them where you're going, okay, if the first one doesn't do very well,
then
we're sitting on
you're waiting around for your own funeral.
This other one.
Right. By the way, can we just talk about scale here for a minute? Because I love this idea that it was like, it didn't do any well that well.
Oh,
it was like 800 million.
No, sure.
And it was just like,
poor Ultron
like,
made 1.4.
No. Barely a billion.
I've just... talking, I'm trying to express what happens in the mind of a studio executive.
Yeah, I get it.
Which
is
a scary, dark place. But, so it was, for as big and corporate a thing as it is on one level, it was also we had to stop and go like, could be a fall on your face moment. Mm.
Right, but we also knew it was the biggest puzzle we'd ever face. And it's almost like, certainly in blockbuster filmmaking, it's the biggest puzzle any writer is going to have to face. It's two movies, it's 23 characters, at least in the first one. Given the ambition of what we wanted to do, particularly in the second movie, there's just a lot of moving pieces.
Yeah.
So we knew it would drain us, and then we would be husks on the other end, as was kind of everyone involved in it. Many people went to the hospital over the course of their, you know, 2 years in Atlanta.
I went to the hospital.
But we also sort of subscribed to the idea that, you know, if it scares you, you really should think about doing it.
Well, the stakes weren't just financial, obviously. I mean, there were story stakes involved.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, this was sort of meant to be sort of this grand conclusion, this bridge into a whole other, you know, generation for the universe. Yeah. So all of that was on you guys.
In a way, not. I mean, there have been so many franchises where they've either petered out or you get a repetitive effect. And this, from the top down, was always supposed to be an ending. And you don't get that opportunity.
Yeah.
And many people who have attempted endings have not done so well. And there was a lot of responsibility on our part to not fuck up the humans in these stories. Because we knew, you know, there's a huge team of professionals and a pile of money that's going to handle the fighting
the other stuff.
And the spaceships and the beams that come out of people's eyes. You know, but if people aren't interested in the characters, that's our job.
Right.
And that's really the thing that makes it, you know, a grand conclusion or a fireworks show.
Yeah, that's the difference between exactly the spectacle and the depth that actually gets people to go again and again.
But it's why we did take it, right? Yeah. If somehow we were being asked to kick the can down the road, that's not that interesting to us. We were not going to. We can't write a good movie that way. That's one of the secrets of the Marvel universe, is that they're not sequels. It's television. Mm-hmm. It's really expensive television, right? The characters grow and they change and they get to different places. And
it's
not just 10% different from the previous one as it was in the 80s.
It's good television.
Yes.
Right. It's not like Love Boat. They didn't grow.
Television now is
don't
really
shit
good.
On Love Boat.
No, I mean, some of it.
I grew up on Love Boat.
I'm just saying sequels, the traditional, when people are bad-mouthing sequels and people who don't go to the Marvel movies bad-mouth the Marvel movies, they are thinking more like a CSI, where it's the same thunk.
Yep.
Right. I watched a lot of CSI. I'm not bad.
Right.
But this is more like a piece of long. I mean, I would say more that it's part and parcel of this rediscovery of long form storytelling that the world is going through. And, you know, for all the think pieces we get about how particleized all our information is and we can't digest anything more than this big, and there's a big movement toward people really wanting and demanding long form product, both on a TV level and on a movie series level and on a like podcasts.
Yeah.
Like, I remember my father used to complain that about talk shows that, like, they used to really have conversations. Now it's just like 5 seconds, a couple jokes, and it's over. He missed the
good night, everybody.
Dick Cavett
check,
you know. But like Mark Maron, you know, talks for an hour and a half to these people, and people love it because, you know. So it's weird in that while we're all complaining that our brains are dying, we're becoming much more open to. Right. Big, long, complicated
depth. Yeah,
things.
We're hungry for depth.
We can ask more of audiences.
Yeah. Were you guys into comic books when you were kids?
I was not. I was more of a Star Wars kid. Chris
My cousin gave me a big box of comic books.
All like plastic wrapped?
No, like torn up. And she was older than me, so they were probably from the 60s, but they were like not in great shape. So don't get upset when I say they're not around anymore. But I would read those over and over and over again.
Were there particular superheroes that you kind of gravitated towards?
I did read a lot of Avengers. And
really?
Spider-Man and eventually X-Men. And but then, you know, I got into high school and people started looking at me funny. And
you wanted
like,
to date
girls. No, I also, come on. But I did start to read things without pictures in them for a while. But,
well, I'm curious, just since you've had this long relationship with comic books, You dated them, I would say.
Yes, sure. Yeah.
Deep, lasting love affair.
They were handed to him in a box.
We still talk. They were handed in a box with some Kleenex and some lotion.
Look, dry skin can be a problem, especially in cold weather.
As you were growing older, so how old were you when you got the box?
Oh, I was probably like eight.
Okay, eight. Yeah. So for what, maybe a decade you were reading these things?
Less, probably.
But I'm curious, like, how your relationship to the comics or to the heroes themselves changed. Like, how, as you got older, did the way that you read these comics shift, and how?
Well, I think that's where Marvel comes in. Mm. The Marvel Comics Stan Lee style is built for adolescence, and it's built around how horrible adolescence is, and all the characters. You know, Spider-Man's literally going through it, and everybody else is all kind of contorted in a way that you really get at that age.
It's me.
Where it's like, if you read Superman or Batman, you're like, "Oh, that's cool," but I don't really have a ton in common with them. That phase of Marvel heroes were all screwed up. And as a kid, you're like, and that's the sort of the secret of that era Marvel success, is that it's not kids fantasizing about being superheroes. It's kids like, it's the same effect of reading Catcher in the Rye or something. It's like, oh shit, somebody understands
me.
And there's Spider-Man in it. Right. But it's like, there's a very good grasp of the adolescent psyche in there, so.
But not you. You never got into comics.
No, I was Dungeons and Dragons slightly, and Star Wars pretty big, yeah.
But what did you, I mean, so Star Wars obviously deeply, Star Wars obviously has an enormous depth of mythology in it, you know, ideas of good and evil and destiny and prophecy, all of that stuff. I mean, that must have had a huge effect on you as a writer.
Oh, for sure. I'm not really joking when I say this. I kind of just try to keep making Empire Strikes Back, Raiders of the Lost Ark, Star Trek II, Wrath of Khan, and Aliens over and over again, because those are the movies that, you know, punch me in the face when I was at the right age.
And I just keep going, we did that last time.
It's working.
It's fine.
Stick with it.
Find a new movie from your past.
That kind of blockbuster genre storytelling really got me sort of when I was 10 to 14.
Is that what made you want to be a writer?
Ah, geez. It made me want to be a film writer ultimately, but I certainly didn't understand that those movies were written at that time.
Right.
You know, that was much later that...
Neither does the studios. They don't understand that either.
Only just think Topic it just knows.
Actors are only just finding out.
Yeah. No, actors just, they're just, you know, making up their words.
I made that up, didn't I? I think I did.
You guys met in college, right? In undergrad?
Graduate school.
Graduate school. Yeah. What was the context of that?
UC Davis.
UC Davis.
Physics department.
That's right. Mm.
We were walking by the physics. No.
Wait,
that's right.
For just a minute, I was like, wait, what?
Really?
What?
Research!
That can't. I did not get that in the
any UC
of these
Davis
notes.
Creative Writing Graduate Program.
Legendary
fiction
graduate
section.
Program.
Legendary if you write about nature and pretty much nature and the lower Sierras.
You guys both wanted to be novelists, right?
Kind of, yeah, that was the
idea. I'd have taken it, but...
So basically, this is just the story of two more failed novelists
in Hollywood.
Is that what we're talking about here? Is that what's happening?
I'm very pleased with how it all shook out, but it became very clear that that writing a novel wasn't going to allow us to eat food.
Exactly.
So we went, where do they let you eat food for the writing, right? And we eventually made our way down here. Yeah.
The whiff of craft services.
Exactly. Wait, you're telling me I can eat as much of that as I want?
All of this? All the M&Ms you can eat?
That's right.
So you guys met in the workshop, experience.
We were two of eight people in the room.
And how'd that go? Like, did you just get along right away? Because, I mean, I've been in a workshop, and I hated everybody.
Our year got along pretty well. The next year, there came some hate.
That's
some
right.
hate was injected.
We occupied very similar spaces as sort of smartass, right? There were other people who were perhaps more serious or more talented, but Chris and I were sort of
know. Or more nature-oriented.
Yeah, more nature-oriented.
So then what made you guys decide to start working together? How did that happen?
Well, literally, it's in my apartment on a Saturday, watching my little
night.
Little mm-hmm. TV. I don't think it was night.
Night.
I don't think it was night, because no. Baywatch wasn't on at night. And we were watching Baywatch.
As one is wont to do.
Such a good show. Mm-hmm. And we realized that someone
great
wrote
writing.
It. Great writing.
Huge writing.
Well, the what was
huge,
really appealing
gorgeous
is
writing.
Not a ton of words in that. Like, there's some words set up, mm-hmm. then a lot of running, and then a little more setup, and then some running. And we thought...
So basically an Avengers movie.
Wow, really? Is this how you treat... Did you treat the Pulitzer Prize winner this way?
Yeah, come back with the Pulitzer.
Little do you know, Pulitzer Prize winner also got to start watching.
That's right.
But we thought, okay, I mean, it was just sort of a test case of like, okay, that's a... somebody wrote that. Well, that is a job a writer has.
Right.
Because, sort of, you know, at this point, everybody in the program is talking about, you know, okay, it's a 2-year program.
Yeah, we're like, about to graduate.
And
yeah,
people are going like, I hear maybe the Banana Republic catalog can get paid to write in that. And I was like,
right. No, but it's about you would get a job in publishing or you get a job writing technical manuals or something like that.
There was always that one guy who had spent 2 years crafting the most perfect short story.
Right.
And that got in.
But that's
absolutely, like, we had heard the success story from the program a couple years earlier. Like, somebody, we could go to what was then Bookstar and look on the shelf and there her novel was. And we went, oh, I can see the.
It happened.
I can see it from here. Right. Can I ask how much did they make? Well, it took her 3 years, and she made $10,000. And we went, oh, that's not food money, is it? Well, I gotta
also,
have another
that's
job.
That's in three installments.
That's what
way.
I mean. Yeah. Like, it's so around this time, as we are realizing that things on television are written, my uncle, for that Christmas, would have been 94, gave me a book, because he knew I was in graduate school for writing, gave me a book, How to Sell Your Story to Hollywood. And I went, whoa, I don't know any of these words. This is crazy. Yeah. And so I brought it to Chris. And I know, and I guess because you were my friend there at the time, and we had been, I don't know if we've been talking, but I don't know if we've been talking yet about what to do next.
I don't know. We did plot out 2 Baywatches just to see if we could do it. I don't remember whether that was before or after the book.
That's right.
I see those, please? Yeah.
They were genius.
Perhaps amazing plot twist.
Little meta.
We're a little meta. Pam Anderson befriends a prostitute.
Who wants to go straight
because her pimp isn't that nice, and so it turns out the pimp's not nice. We started
slightly unfriendly pimp.
So she goes through the lifeguard training program. Mm-hmm.
This is like the
B plot. I can't remember what the A plot.
The A plot was
the B plot.
Underwater.
Mitch finds his sunken Japanese submarine.
I was just gonna say, did it involve a treasure?
It did.
World War II sub.
Yeah, of course. Yeah,
the effects budget on this one episode alone.
Even then,
don't leave me hanging. What happened to her?
Oh, sorry. So she goes to the program.
Did she make it?
Yes, and she succeeds. But around that time, the pimp finds out where she is, and he comes to the Santa Monica Beach, right? And he says, "Hey, what's that dirty whore doing over there?" And then Mitch stands up and says, "That's no whore. That's an L.A. County lifeguard."
Damn!
Give me the Oscar now.
Damn.
Good stuff.
I don't mean this to come out the wrong way, but when did you do something good?
Yeah, understood.
A couple of years later. Well, what we did, he got the book.
Yeah.
So we're like, okay, that's a thing. Mm-hmm. And we wrote a thriller for college credit.
We had a sympathetic teacher who said, we'll give you three credits if... You actually write a whole screenplay.
That was one of the great things is the head of the program did not, despite the fact that this was a nature-oriented fiction and poetry program, and I keep saying that like it's a bad thing. It's a lovely thing. It's amazing. But
I don't even know what you mean by that. Like, did it involve sloths?
Gary Snyder.
It would involve appreciating
now I get it.
The Lower Sierras. But he had seen enough classes go through and enough promising people go on to careers as waiters to not go like, Hollywood? He was like, yeah, that's a thing. Yeah. That is a thing writers do, you know? And yeah, I will give you credit if you actually do that, because I would like somebody from this program
to continue writing.
Yeah, right. So we wrote a thriller.
Because Seven had come out.
Yeah.
Oh, and this is dating us a little bit. But mm-hmm. yeah.
Was horrendous. Like, just so unthrilling and laughably bad and, like, sort of pious and terrifying. Yeah. And we finished it, and we never showed it to anybody, which is probably the single best mm-hmm. decision we've done over the course of the last 20 years was put that in the drawer.
Light that on fire.
That thing mm-hmm. sucks. Right. We're not proud of it, you know, because you get a lot of people who are very proud that they finished a thing and then mm-hmm. they want to, you know, and I understand, but like, read it.
Right. You guys, take a week and read it. Give some thought to pulling it out. I think Netflix will buy it.
Just buy that thing.
Yeah. You know.
Halfway through, because again, we're learning all of this at once, right? Because we don't know anything about screenwriting. We're not taking a screenwriting class. We're there to write fiction. Mm. And so we're buying books and reading about margins and all sorts of stuff, lines.
And we didn't have a program.
There's no
either.
Program. This is no, just we Microsoft just Word and we're indenting
button.
And creating this little thing. And so it was laborious just on that level. But halfway through, we're just making fun of this because we know we've picked a genre that's not us. And so the guy would lean over the body and he'd say something hilarious and we'd go, I'd love it if you could say that. We can't say that. And we vowed that when we write another one, I'm glad that we wrote another one and we didn't just, you know, we said, we're going to leave that stuff in. Mm. And that's going to be because it's us and, you know, it's not chasing something we saw at the Cineplex. And that became our spec script, that next thing, and eventually got made, but it was never intended to. Mm-hmm. But it was definitely it spoke to us, and it spoke about us really.
And by that point, we had moved to LA and had jobs we didn't like, so there was a real impetus to write another one. It wasn't like we were comfortable, so it was. This literally is the end of the idea,
mm-hmm.
unless we crank something else out. So
I guess your first taste of success was The Life and Death of Peter Sellers, right? Mm-hmm. How did that come about?
We had written...
We wrote a true story.
That's what
an it was. We wrote a true story for the actor Bill Pullman, who had the rights to an article. And we were not in the Guild. So we didn't even mm-hmm. demand guild minimum at that point, which is actually a good thing.
You were like, I'll do it for a bucket of chicken.
It's kind of what it was.
It was a bucket of chicken, but it was a fascinating story. And we paid the rent. And it didn't get made. It almost got made. It didn't get made, but it was a much better sample for certain things. And so it got in the hands of some agents who then put it in the hands of HBO, who had the book, Life and Death of Peter Sellers, but didn't really know what to do with it yet. And we went in and kind of won the cattle call.
Right.
With a pitch that we pitched something. I don't even quite remember what it was.
I remember what it was.
And they loved it.
What was the pitch?
And then they called us the next day and said, it is... Legal has informed us it is
the most expensive movie
utterly prohibited to make that movie.
Sellers would have told all the characters he would have played were going to tell the story of Sellers' life. So you had to get the rights to the guy from The Party. You had to get the rights to everybody from Strangelove, Clouseau.
Because when you do a biopic and someone's dressed as that, you don't need to do the rights. When you are saying it is that character, suddenly you have now stolen property.
That's right.
So we had to come up with a different variation on it.
Yeah. It's so funny that when you were like, it's, you know, they told us it was really expensive. And I was like, what were
HBO
you going to...
HBO expensive.
Yeah, HBO. It's like, what happens in the script? You're like, well, Peter Sellers picks up New York and then just drops it on the ground.
Effects were very expensive back then.
That's right.
And then from there, I guess really the two kind of major franchises that you guys have made your name on, both, you know, sort of fantasy, sci-fi, Narnia, yeah. and Marvel, but two dramatically different experiences, yeah?
Oh, well, yeah. Everyone was nice enough, but that franchise didn't, it didn't take off, say, like, no franchise has taken off like Marvel has.
Right.
So we had done The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. We'd come in Actually, the Sellers script is what got us that job, because Andrew Adamson, the director, had read it and really liked it, and liked the voice and the idea that we were, you know, sort of writers for adults, and he didn't want kids writers or fantasy writers to come in and, and help him.
So we came in on a rewrite on that one.
All right. And then we stayed on Prince Caspian, and then we got fired off of Voyage of the Dawn Treader.
But it was like a film school, kind of. I mean, those were our first really big movies,
right.
And we were on the set for a bunch of some of them.
Mm-hmm.
And they were all different. We rewrote on the first one. Mm-hmm. We co-wrote with Andrew as a team on the second one, and we were rewritten on the third one.
Right.
So it was a nice little sort of lifespan of the Hollywood writer.
But it was also like your first experience of having to navigate sort of the complexities of a canon, right?
And, oh, yeah.
Yeah,
and
sure.
Dealing with like all
a
the different
fan base
people who
and
are
all
involved
that. Yeah.
In it. And
yeah.
the people who own the
yeah.
the stories
yeah.
and the rights and the
yeah.
arguments between,
yeah.
you know, the estate and,
yes.
I mean, that could
and
not have been an easy...
Sitting down and looking at something that is delightful, but not a movie.
Yeah. Right.
And having the pressure from the studio to, you know, kind of make it a lot less delightful, but much more resemble a movie. And you're like, what have I gotten?
Yeah. And the right. fan base.
Couldn't the witch come back? No, you killed her.
No, and but it's what's
she came,
funny.
She came back.
Yeah, she came back.
With Narnia, not only are you dealing with this sort of rabid fan base, but there's also this kind of religious aspect.
Yeah, I knew
to
you
it, right?
were going
to
get around.
Yeah, I was going to bring
yeah.
it up.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because, I mean, it was...
Aslan's the lion.
Well, I'm just saying.
Understood.
So if Aslan is Jesus and your last
that's
name
right.
is Aslan...
I think you can put the
yeah,
pieces exactly. together,
it makes
Chris.
A lot of sense.
I think
that's
you just
right.
draw a line.
That's right.
Just call the show.
So this is my funny Narnia story, is that I've spent most of my life in America having... people lose their shit when they hear my name, you know?
Okay.
Because it's that kind of
right.
fan base,
yeah.
right? Again, it's
right.
not just, oh, I love these stories.
Right.
It's like, no, this lion is my personal lord and savior.
Yeah.
I mean, not really.
Right,
it's
right.
a lion,
right.
whatever.
Right.
And then I have to tell those people that I've never read the books.
Right.
And the look on their faces, they're just like, I mean, horrified.
Reza, you have to read
now, in my defense, by the time right. I could read English, I was too old to read those books.
Right.
But
you're never too old for the message.
Is that right? Is that, you mean salvation is always there for me? Wow. Nice, Chris. Thank
second
you.
Second floor.
I appreciate that. But, you know, in some ways, I know it sounds weird, but that kind of prepared you for
oh, sure.
the madness
oh,
that you were about to
no,
experience.
We now live in a Hollywood which is all about IP, right? And it's sort of awful to call C.S. Lewis's books IP, but they are in some ways. So people started hiring us because they knew we wouldn't screw up their IP.
Mm.
And particularly that first movie is really kind of a nice, lovely, you know, it's a bit of a love letter to the book. It's the book itself is three acts in a way some of the other ones aren't,
right?
You know, so I think we got a reputation as guys who could get along with others and, you know, work within a system.
And also for the first two, we stayed on through shooting,
yeah.
you mm-hmm. know, and we were able to work within a system where, you know, we learned what the other departments needed, and we were able to
right.
not. You know, somebody will listen to this and go, yeah, you just did what anybody told you. It's like, no, we collaborated because that's how movies get made.
Let's talk about craft.
Services?
Craft services, yeah.
Oh,
all, I'm telling you.
Little
crackers,
candies.
Cheese,
yes.
all you can eat. Obviously, you guys have a deep, long-lasting relationship as friends and as, you know, creatives. I'm just curious, how does the collaboration work with the two of you? I mean, like, nuts and bolts-wise, how does it work? I don't mean, like, can you actually stand each other? Wait, can you stand each other?
Can generally stand each other.
Generally, yeah, more or less, yeah. But, I mean, take us through the creative process. How do you guys work together?
Well, more often than not, we've adapted. A pre-existing book, a comic book,
mm-hmm.
True story. So we will sort of ingest all the source material we can get. And then initially just start talking about, or maybe even 3x5 carding, just things we liked from within it. Scenes, mm-hmm. weird revelations about a person and start just put them out on the floor or on the right. table in a kind of haphazard cloud and start going like, well, that's, you know, if you dragged that through a movie, that's right. a hell of an arc for a character, right. that one fucked up
that
scene.
That's a candidate for the midpoint, or that's right. what's the worst thing to happen to this main character, right? Mm-hmm. Oh, it's probably that card. It feels like the end of act two. You know, you sort of, or you say, you did the same thing seven times with seven different people. Probably can't do all that.
Right.
Pick the best one, you know? Mm-hmm. So it tends to winnow it, we winnow it.
Yeah. And then you connect the dots?
Yeah, I mean, then we begin to figure out a story. You know, if it's like when you're adapting comics, it's more often than not a pretty brand new story with components right. that right. you've seen. Then we begin probably the hardest part and the most sort of, I use soul sucking in the best possible sense of the word.
Oh,
process
the best sense
where
of the word
it really is us locked in a room just suggesting things and watching them die and suggesting right. things and watching right. them die until things begin to stick. And that takes longer than it does to write.
Yeah.
And it is probably the hardest part and the most important part because there's two of us.
Right.
Like, we can't improvise because I'll just screw over what he's writing. Mm. If I toss everything out and go, I had a brainstorm last night.
right.
And he's like, well, thanks.
Hulk's a woman now.
That's right.
Yeah. But you must have like certain strengths and weaknesses, right? Like,
let's
do this.
You want to do this one?
I'm going to tell you what your strengths and weaknesses are. No,
yeah.
I was just going to ask you like what your strengths and weaknesses are, but I think it'd be more fun for you to tell me what his strengths and weaknesses are.
Tell me what my weaknesses are.
That's right. Upper body strength.
No. working on it.
Chris, unlike me, is slower to enthusiasm, right? and mm-hmm. what that does is it vets everything.
Right.
So I have a tendency to go, that's an idea. We should do this idea mm-hmm. that I just had. Mm-hmm. If you had an idea, we should do that too. Let's just do that idea. And he goes, okay. What if we don't do this idea?
What if it's not a good idea?
Yeah, let's go down the road two steps in this idea. Okay, fine, but now we have no ideas, right? So that's so he's a little slower in that regard, and that vets the whole thing. He also, mm-hmm. In terms of how we work generally, he sort of is the carpenter towards the end of the process. So I carry a lot of the load early in terms of mm-hmm. structure and putting stuff on whiteboards and sort of just generally, you know, keeping trains running. And Chris towards the end is the one that goes, this line can be 15% better. Mm-hmm. And we sit at his computer and it runs through him.
So you're Iron Man and he's Hawkeye. But he's just sort of semi-helpful, is what you're saying. You do most of the work.
That is not what I said in any way.
You do most of the work, and he kind of shows up and, does this a few times.
Like, he's the Hulk. He lifts heavy things.
Right. What about Chris's weakness? Or was that it?
What are you talking about? That's
that was largely weakness.
My God. No, I mean, it's
incontinence.
What am I going to say?
All right, we'll just leave it there.
I know what my weaknesses are.
Tell us what your weakness is, and then I'm going to see if Steve agrees.
Everyone's weaknesses are often the shadowy side of their strengths, lack of enthusiasm, and possibly not the best level of concentration you've ever seen.
The internet hurt us a lot.
He's just surfing the web.
I found ways to drift mm-hmm. off even before the internet. But you now want his strength.
I want, yeah.
He's really looking forward to this.
Leg day, that's his strength.
He's unbelievably well organized and makes things happen. As opposed to, you know, being critical is a nice thing, but it just means nothing. You kill things. And literally nothing would be created at the end of the process. Mm-hmm. So he pushes it forward and he builds the structure and writes it on the board and keeps things in his head so that it becomes a extremely sound thing as opposed to a bunch of little flourishes with no spine, which is what distinguishes, I think, the movies we've made from other people's movies mm-hmm. where they bog down and you don't know what it's about. Like, these things chug along, not in a formula way, but mm-hmm. in a, you know, I would rather be on a bridge that is very well made because right. I know I'm not going to die at the end. And that gives me the ability to go look at the scenery on either side. If you're on a terrifying, poorly built bridge, you're not going to know what you pass right. by because you're worried about dying the entire time. So, a brand new metaphor.
No, I like that. Yeah. That's yeah. pretty good.
Brand new.
Yeah.
And then is there a weakness that you want to...
I didn't say yours.
I'm trying to break this relationship up is what I'm trying to say. I have an idea for a script that I want to pitch to
he
Steve.
He likes...
That's and you're
right.
in the way.
That's right. That's right.
He likes more things than I do.
Well, that's the thing. Like I was going to say, I would put it... Chris's inner critic is loud and mine is not very loud.
Right.
And his should be quieter and mine should be louder.
How do you guys deal with like disputes or differences? You know, I mean, is it just...
We've learned that, particularly on big movies that we're working with a lot yeah. of people on, that, you know, you put up your dukes a little bit, but you realize that there's going to be another chance at biting this apple mm. if this doesn't work. You know, like this isn't the end of the line for this conversation. So that happens all the time where one yeah. guy just goes, this guy clearly wants it more or has a better reasoned argument other than I just don't like it.
Yeah.
So we'll go down the road. And then if it didn't work, then...
You can always keep it yeah. in your back pocket. Yeah. But more, I mean, 99% of the time, you know, if you cut and paste that little thing because yeah. there's a diamond in there.
Right.
And open it the next day, and I cannot find the diamond for the life of me. I was like, I was sure this was fucking brilliant yesterday, but it literally right. says the exact same thing that he proposed that pissed me off. Yeah. So it's, you know,
yeah.
which is, you know, part of the delusional quality of writing, which is what allows you to write, because,
yeah.
like, writing is fundamentally, from the outside, kind of ridiculous. I'm gonna sit down with some paper and tell a story about some people who do some stuff. It's
make
like,
you
why don't you
things.
Go get dig a hole in real life or do something, help people? But you have to get kind of junked up on how great it is in order to keep going, you know, and feel a little bit of energy there, which might not actually be there, but it's the only thing that's gonna get you to the end. Yeah, I've read our first drafts. The magic is, the magic leaves by the back door in the night.
Well, and if that weren't complicated enough, you have to deal with sort of the entire Marvel machine, right? I mean, that in and of itself mm-hmm. has its own yeah. process through which a story is constructed and the scripts are written. I read somewhere that you guys referred to yourselves as not just screenwriters, but mm-hmm. Marvel's R&D department, which right. I think is
amazing. That has been the case for a
long time. Amazing. Yeah, and so I guess what I'm curious about is, you know, it's enough work already to sort of maintain all of the, yeah. the sort of narrative arcs that are involved in any one of these scripts. But how do you then kind of balance that with all the other stories, all the other characters, all, you know, that Marvel's yeah. got the next 30 years planned, you know? I mean,
loose.
That's the shtick, though. Like, you know.
Oh, it's all a lie.
Well, it's some advertising.
It's a retroactive lie.
Yeah. It's a retro.
Yeah. Like these movies wouldn't be good if they knew exactly what they were going to be every time. They have general thoughts.
Yeah.
Like literally, they handed us Thanos, and we went, "All right, Thanos." Right.
We'll go look his ass up.
Yeah. So it's not like the story was handed to us in any way, and neither is the slate. So. When the question comes up, how do you deal with all those other things? What they're really good at, Kevin Feige sort of just, you know, this is his mantra. You're going to write the movie and make the movie in front of you. And that is the thing you have to make as best as you can. And if that means borrowing from something that would be amazing in somebody else's movie, screw them, right? You've got to make this meal first. And that person will make a different meal.
Mm. Yeah, you know, you don't get a third movie if you fuck up the second.
Wait, has anyone ever stole your shit?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
I mean, there have been occasionally
stealing. They just have the thing that we wanted to use.
Mm. Yeah. Know?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, there is no theft.
In yeah, that's not really.
Theft. You know, in also the in a genre that's based on 70 years of storytelling, yeah. A lot of these stories have been told in different ways. And if you're going like, no, I was going to use the mad bomb.
That's
from
right.
1965.
I'm the one that said Hulk got angry.
Yeah, exactly. Like that was me. Right. Yeah, we're all playing in the same box. So, but you ask, you know.
Yeah.
And the Marvel has a good system of the EP on each movie. Mm. They sort of gather together and tell each other what they're up to and what they're thinking about. But it's very loose. Mm-hmm. It is a kind of improvisational studio, which is a crazy thing to attempt,
right. But
it seems to have worked.
You know, one of the oldest debates in writing has to do with the idea of the protagonist, right? Mm-hmm. More specifically, how many protagonists can a story have? Right. And the thing is the protagonist isn't the main character of the story. That's the wrong way to think of who the protagonist is. Yeah. The protagonist is the eyes through which you experience the story, right? The protagonist is the motivation that drives the narrative forward. And so what a lot of writers will say, I mean, I remember my teachers saying this all the time, is that you can't really have more than one protagonist, right? If you have more than one protagonist, then you have multiple motivations, right. Multiple drives, multiple goals. It doesn't make sense. I mean, maybe you could have like two protagonists if you separate them in, you know, different chapters. Maybe you can have three or four protagonists if you're like Faulkner good, you know?
Yeah.
You guys have 23 protagonists.
So we're like six times as good as Faulkner.
That's exactly what I'm trying to say. Yeah.
Six Faulkners.
You are six Faulkners.
Think
that's what you
of
are.
The alcohol it would take to power.
But
six
I mean, it's
Faulkners.
Like, I mean, honestly, when I was reading about your work and sort of the criticism, the comments,
yeah.
The thing that always bothered me is that the Avengers movies, especially these last two Avengers movies, are often described as ensemble films, and they're not ensemble films. An ensemble film means there's a protagonist, and then there are like six beautiful people around that protagonist.
Yeah.
But you are talking about 23 fully realized three-act narrative arcs, you know, for each of these characters, which is insane.
I don't know if they're all fully realized.
All right, well,
fully.
Maybe a few of them are
fully
less realized. Probably disappointed when they're fully three-act
arcs. And if that's not enough, you know, you were mentioning Thanos earlier. I guess technically he's the antagonist.
No, he's the protagonist.
But that's what I was going to say. Yeah. He's not even
movie.
The antagonist.
In the first movie, he's the protagonist.
Yeah. It's the only way we could get through it.
How do you juggle that? I mean, first of all, it's such a violation of every rule of writing.
Yeah.
But how do you juggle it all?
Well, it's a very special situation. In the first movie, we had 18 movies behind us.
Yeah.
And in the second movie, we had 21 movies behind
us.
So I'm not saying it made the job easier. If anything, it made the job harder. But it did allow us to be leaner in terms of character setup, because everybody knew who they were and their basic dynamics, so that we could get into plot and get these people into situations as fast as possible, which gave us more elbow room.
We also ranked them, right? There's Groot and Mantis do not have the
Groot arc. Doesn't get three acts.
No, but he gets a beginning, middle, and end.
Wait,
right?
2023 solo Groot movie?
Solo Groot movie.
Yeah.
But he at least gets to contribute at the end, right?
Because one guy got that joke.
He goes,
one guy. The Avengers nerd in the back got that joke.
Go ahead. You know, but he goes from sullen teenager to a guy who contributes by cutting his arm off and picking up a hammer.
Yeah.
Oh my God, right? But Thor, say, goes through a much bigger journey. He's got more screen time. He's got more pathos. He's got a lot going on. But yeah, when attacking that, we had something like 23 characters that would that would appear on the poster one day, and said, "Oh my God, we can't do it if we do it a traditional way, all right? Or the traditional way we have to do it is to just flip it so that Thanos is going to be the guy that's driving everything. And in the structure of the movie, the Avengers are the antagonists.
Yeah. Right.
Right. Right. That's the only way we could do it.
And in both movies, we decided early on we're going to have to break these people into subsets. You know, you can't have... Mm-hmm. You'd need a tour guide. Okay, all the Avengers!
That's right. Get a buddy.
So the first movie is three-ish sets of heroes kind of weaving through the universe.
Right.
And the same in the second, where they're traveling through time. Which let us give more meat to each person because you didn't have to share the room with 40 people. You only had to share it with two. And, you know, you just kind of go from there and you do draft after draft where, okay, we know Natasha sucks in this one. You know,
right.
But we're going to go and we're going to do the Natasha pass.
We'll do
the
Natasha pass.
And we'll do that for everybody.
Right.
And just keep tuning them so that they are primarily saying emotional character things and not plot things. Mm-hmm. You know, because you start off with this obsession with getting the plot across, and some of these plots are really obscure, and you're like, okay, there are six Infinity Stones, but audiences get that very quickly, more quickly than we think in the first draft. Usually there's a lot more plot in the first drafts, and it gets pared away as you realize people aren't dumb. You know, mm-hmm. you explain something one time, they're like, I get it, and they're very familiar with story tropes. And not to say you're telling a cliched story, but you're working within sort of corridors people have walked down before, and you don't have to hold their hand. And it gives you much more time when you can push that stuff to the back to do character work in front and make it feel like...
Right.
Unique to the story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey there, everyone. It's Reza. I'm sorry for the interruption. I just wanted to pop in and say that if you're enjoying this episode, well, then you're in luck, my friends, because Rough Draft is also a TV show, and you can watch it all right now, along with Topic's other original series and exclusive programming from around the world. You can check it out for free on the Apple TV app, which is already on your favorite devices. With Apple TV, you can watch Topic at home or on the go with offline viewing, and you can even share your subscription with up to 6 family members with family sharing, which is what I do because I have a gigantic family. Go to apple.co/topic to start your 7-day free trial now. That's apple.co/topic.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
So this goes back to where we kind of started, which was the core element of the craft that you guys work with is dialogue. And so this notion that dialogue is not meant to move plot forward, it's meant to reveal character, I think is precisely what makes these films special. They're not just superhero movies. There's a deep well of emotion and connection that we have to all of these characters. What's the trick there? What's the trick in figuring out a way to use a person's words to say everything about the journey that that person's on? And can you write that trick for me?
For you.
Yes.
Yes.
That's right. Do you have a cocktail
just
napkin?
Just whisper it in my ear.
Yes. Use more ease.
It's a tough question to answer, obviously. Like, I've often said that scenes need to do more than one thing. And if this is the scene where character is revealed, and that's all that's doing, that's all that's happening in that scene, you screwed up the scene, right? So if you go through Infinity War and Endgame, you'll find, particularly Infinity War, because the real estate is so precious, that most scenes are doing a number of different things, right? You're in the opening, right? You're introducing your big bad, right? You are getting rid of Loki, your previous big bad, right? But showing in the way that he says goodbye to his brother that he's come around to a degree in a way that is tantalizing, and I only wish that that Loki would stick around. He's gone, right? Yeah. You've introduced, you've killed other characters, Heimdall, right? You've put Thor on a mission of vengeance, right? Even though at the moment we think he might be dead, but of course we don't think he's dead because he's Chris Hemsworth. You've established the plot, right? Because these monsters are going to go to Earth and get me the stones and come back and rendezvous with me on Titan, right? So me and the audience go, ah, I've heard Titan. I know that's important. I know stones, those people are going to go meet with him. And then stones. I may not know
everything about stones. Character.
Yeah, for sure. And I saw that Thanos beat the living hell out of the Hulk, and oh my God, we're screwed. Right, if that guy's coming for us, you know, think about that 7 or 8 different things that have happened there. Dialogue
is like
the
first 7 minutes, by the way.
Right, but it is the first scene. And so in terms of dialogue, probably the most important accomplishment of that scene is introducing Thanos, right? How's he gonna talk? How impressive is he? Mm-hmm. What is his level of respect for other characters? Because that'll grow. He doesn't seem to respect that many people in this scene, right? But towards the end of the movie, he has some kind of respect for Tony, and that lands, you know, and you go, oh, he seems to understand that Tony was trying to, you know, do his utmost, and he's not here about killing Tony. He's got a mission. That's the best way I can explain it, is that that every one of those scenes needs to do a
many
lot.
Things,
right?
Yeah.
You can't wander.
You talk about something that's so important and such a great lesson for screenwriters, which is the difference between implicit and explicit dialogue,
right?
That what a character isn't saying is often way more important than what that character is saying. Yeah. So often I think young writers especially, you know, they want to just kind of use the words coming out of the mouth to basically say, this is how I feel.
That's right.
These are the things going on in my mind.
Right? Much better to say, what's the point of the scene, right? I want him to express his love to her, right? So now the challenge is, he never says that.
Without ever saying
but
it.
But by the end, but when you get to page 5, you should know that's exactly how he feels. Now go.
That's good writing. Let's talk about themes here for a minute. I think there's a lot of explanations for why superhero movies are so huge, so popular, so, you know, so much a part of the global zeitgeist. I have my idea about why. I'd love to hear your idea about why before I tell you why you're wrong and I'm right.
Understood. At least you're going to wait. That's nice.
I'm kind enough to... Yeah. I mean, I'm just going to edit this part
out. It's
your
show.
But, you know, go ahead and just talk about it if you'd like. What do you think? What's happening? I mean, it's more than... it's to say that it's captured the imagination of people across the world, or that it's in the zeitgeist, like those, that doesn't... I don't think give it justice.
Okay, I'll ask you questions. Do you think it is more than just its time in the sun, right? Like, is it not, back up slightly. Clearly, visual effects have come such a long way that we can actually realize some of the things that Stan Lee had and Jack Kirby had imagined. So there's that, and that's all a new toy to some degree. But isn't it also just the myths of the Western? Right. And, you know, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but like some ridiculous, like throughout the 50s, thousands of Westerns got made. We don't remember them all, because they were sort of fillers. But the classics remain. Isn't it just the need for simple? I don't want to be reductive, but it's not just simple, but like, you know, myth and good guys and bad guys, and then a reflection of the society sometimes. Yeah. We certainly do that, you know. Winter Soldier and Civil War have some small things to say about, you know, the police state and Israeli state and things like that. So many times, I kind of just think it's a viable genre like the rom-com or a Western or sci-fi or anything like that.
I don't know.
I mean, I think it's, one, it's, you know, I think you also have to, and I'm partial, you have to differentiate the the Marvel phenomenon from superhero movies in general. I know Marvel has the sort of lion's share of them, but that interconnected shared world is something that humans crave. Mm-hmm. And also we have very few or fewer and fewer shared experiences. We don't have water cooler shows anymore because everything's chopped into little pieces. You know, I saw the people crying at the end of this movie, and I've seen the box office, and it's not because, ooh, wow, things blow up. It's because this thing that so many people have been invested in at the same time has come to a conclusion. And that's almost impossible to do these days, to get that many eyeballs on a thing. And it's because they cared. It's not because, it's not just escapism. You know, there are people who want to go like,
there's plenty of options if you're looking
they're
for escapism.
Fanboys who like just, bullshit. It is because they connected to the characters and to the actors and to the writing that's in those movies.
Why superhero as opposed to, you know, because Game of Thrones basically was became a water cooler show and people were invested in that way. You know,
Did okay, right?
Yeah. I would argue it's not just
no, I think
superheroes.
It's
Chris is talking about emotional investment that social media and the internet can allow in a way that you couldn't in the 50s. People couldn't go, you know, and sort of sob about High Noon.
Yeah, no,
you know?
this is something of another caliber. So you guys know that when we first talked about doing this, I thought that it would be fun if, you know, we had members of the audience come with their kind of Comic-Con, you know, Marvel nerd questions, you know, and it would be funny if they like stood up and stumped you in some way, like, you know, what's the first Iron Man, what was the combination on Tony Stark's safe?
Offensive voice you're doing.
Thank you very much. It was kind of offensive, and you're right, and I'm willing to admit that I was wrong. I will not make that
adenoidal.
But here's what happened, is that I asked a few friends, some of whom are here, to who are Marvel fans, like big, you know, big time Marvel fans. I asked them to send me some, you know, ideas for what their questions would be, and what they sent me were not nerd questions.
Yeah.
They were like the superhero equivalent of like Talmudic ruminations, you know? It was like hardcore, like scriptural exegesis.
Yeah.
And I had to say to them, I was like, well, this isn't, it's not funny, first of all, you know? Second of all, it's gonna take you 20 minutes to read this thing.
Yeah.
And I don't even get it. I don't even understand it. And I have a degree in this stuff.
Yeah.
I don't get it. And I think part of this has to do with the fact, and let's think about this, right?
Yeah.
So this whole thing starts around the Second World War, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's around the time that, you know, sociologists will say that's when we started talking about God is dead, that religion is over, that evil is real, that we don't need to talk about, you know, these sort of cosmic forces that are controlling our lives. It's right here in front of
us. They just
made it. Exactly.
Yeah.
And suddenly you start to get the rise of these new kinds of mythologies, these superhero mythologies. And maybe this is just the way that my brain thinks anyway. But I think that what's happening is that these superheroes have essentially become our new gods. Because God has just kind of failed us in so many different ways, you know? Like, I always think about this, like, who would you rather avenge you in some way? Like, whose justice are you more interested in? God's justice or Captain America's justice?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, one, I don't know, like, maybe it'll happen.
Old Testament, New Testament,
exactly.
You have to be clear.
Right, even the Old Testament guy. Even the Old Testament guy, you know? And obviously, like, I'm not the first person to note this. This isn't like some new idea. I mean, the DC superheroes, and I don't mean to shit on DC. I do kind of mean to shit on DC, but whatever.
It's your show. The
DC heroes are just basically like Greek gods with capes. I mean, Superman is Zeus, right, and Batman is Hades, and the Flash is Hermes, mm-hmm, and Wonder Woman is literally just a Greek god. Right. They didn't even try with that one. No. They were just like, she's actually a Greek god. In Marvel, it's a little bit more sophisticated, but it's still just the new gods.
They do have Thor.
Yeah, exactly.
Actual Norse god.
So, does that make this scripture? I mean, is this like? Are you guys? I mean, you are writing. You're not writing. You're Jesus, is what I'm trying to say.
No, I'm more like Peter or John.
You're more like I'll give you Paul.
Okay.
I mean, like, I don't mean to make light of this, because there is something very serious here, which is that we are desperate for a modern mythology, right? Yeah. Our old mythologies have failed us, and we're desperate for something new. And this mythology showed up at just the right time. It's not just movies. It's not just a rom-com that I'm into. It's not the Game of Thrones. It's something way, way deeper than that.
Well, I would agree. I mean, I would also, you know, to reduce that, it has been since the 50s through the 70s through now the time of the anti-hero, you know, who we all love. But we've come to a point where we need a hero, where we've all gotten so cynical, and genuinely evil people have risen up and gone, hey, no one's stopping me. That we need the my entire being is based on irony. We desperately need unironic figures to stand up. And I think people know it, and they feel it, and they go, yeah, can we get a grown-up in the room? And as sarcastic and as jokey and as ridiculous as some of the Marvel characters are, they are effectively grown-ups who are going to
fix the problem.
Fix the problem or die trying.
Right.
Or both. That said, a lot of these movies came out before Trump was elected.
Right.
So, you know.
But, and the characters predate all of that. This is not, are we saying that, you know, my religious background is not nearly, you know, as deep as perhaps yours or Rez's, but like, you know.
This is way deeper than mine.
Just kidding, yeah. But, I don't know if I accept this, you know. In this moment, it's well documented that we are in a chaotic spot.
Like, right. I texted my friend the other day, just literally about waterproofing a concrete wall, because he is a contractor. And he said, like, congratulations on the movie. So I sent him a little gif of Cap saluting. And he is not a comic book guy. He's like a heavy metal bass player, actually. And he texted me back, fuck, I wish that guy was real. And I was like, yeah, me too.
Well, so this is interesting, because this really, to me, encapsulates, first of all, just proves my argument and that I'm right, but encapsulates.
What?
You'd have to be right for the whole century, right? Is that what you're saying?
I am right for the whole century.
So I'll grant you that Simon and Kirby created Captain America in March, April of 1941, which is well before Pearl Harbor, right? So in that sense, yes, they're trying to create an American hero who'll stand up, and because, you know, we forget this, but like, there were plenty of people like, I don't want any part of World War II.
Right.
Yeah. And it's only when, you know, Hawaii
fascism
got bombed.
Fascism is the thing that's happening over there. It's not problem. About, yeah, it's not about it. Me.
So
yeah.
Yes, the invention of them was to address address a very specific world issue. But, you know, we had relative peace in the 50s. That's why those things all become about, you know, the atomic bomb, and everyone gets irradiated, and, you know, and that's how I get my superpowers. Because it's not necessarily, we're looking for a hero. It's reflective of the time. That's why I'm reluctant to say that, you know, we're all looking for a savior because God is dead. It's more that this is a template that we sort of, you know, put our anxieties on. And so we have a certain anxiety right now, mm-hmm. right? We had a certain anxiety in 1941, but I'm not positive it's because I think that religion has failed us. I mean, I have my own issues with it, but I'm not positive it's because, you know, God died in 1940 and we just haven't buried him yet.
Well, in each of those
cases, died in 1978.
But this is the thing. Myth is all about meaning, right? Myth isn't, it's not just sort of storytelling for storytelling's sake. It's stories that essentially explain to us why the world is the way that it is.
Yeah.
They're means of explaining what's happening in the world. So of course a myth is going to change constantly as the circumstances change, right?
Right.
So of course the very first time you see Superman, he's punching Hitler in the fucking chin, okay?
Yeah.
Like that is myth-making in its
Cap.
Most...
That's Cap.
Is it
Cap.
Captain?
Yeah,
Cap. Whatever.
Yeah, but, it's fine.
I mean, Superman was fighting gangsters.
This is probably the time that I should probably admit that I've never read comic books, but that's fine. The point being that as our needs change, as our circumstances change, the myth changes to meet those
right.
needs,
yeah.
right? And so in a way, you were saying this really fascinating thing about sort of Captain America and that his purpose was that he's this guy who was like a hero and he becomes this model that Americans can say, like, you know, to be American, we have to go and confront this evil. Because it's what we do. It's what it means to be American. Yes. At the same time, what we're seeing here with these superheroes, in the way that they're replacing God, in the way that the mythology is replacing the sort of scripture as mythology, is that they're offering us a different kind of God, right? A God specifically meant for the 20th and 21st century. Because when you read scripture, when you read sort of the ancient mythologies, what you see is a God who has these sort of superhuman powers, who exists up there and who has nothing to do with me whatsoever, right?
Yeah.
Who does actions that sometimes I'm the, you know, collateral damage of. When you look at comic book heroes, what you see is the normal person, the puny pimpled kid, who is suddenly given God's power, and who becomes the stand-in for the divine, and now it becomes aspirational. You were talking about this when you were reading comics when you were a kid, right? That you see these people who could be you, save for a radioactive spider bite.
Right.
Yes.
You know, they're you.
I let spiders bite me all.
Yeah, exactly. Just in case.
Yeah.
But you're also talking about film in general, because that's all movies are, right? Like, I wanted a whip, after Indiana Jones, right? Like, I watch Star Trek and I want a phaser. Like, I want, I have models, right, that I want to emulate, not, again, because I'm looking for God.
Let me flip it around for you. It's more than you were watching Raiders of the Lost Ark and you're like, I want a whip.
Yeah.
It's that part of what it meant for you to grow up in America as a white dude was this notion of radical individualism. The rules don't apply to you. You've been told that all of your life. And now here's a hero made just for you. A guy who doesn't take shit from anyone, who is by himself,
whips
and motherfucker
around,
and has whips
a whip. Around people.
Has a whip, and I want that whip.
Right.
Stories are about who we are as human beings. They're about how we understand the world. And the world, certainly the last, you know, 50, 60, 70 years of it, has stopped making sense. You know what does make sense? Good and evil.
Yeah.
The good guy and the bad guy. Captain America and, you know, the villain. And I think that there is such desperation for that. Yes, it is true that it's become a more complex story.
Well, all right, I'm glad that we invented stories with good guys and bad guys in the last 50 years. Oh, wait, no, we've had them for thousands
yes.
of years.
Good and evil, absolutely. Protagonists, antagonists, absolutely. But again, how do we actually envision those protagonists, right? Are they becoming sort of mythologized in one way or another? Are they essentially being handed sort of divinity? Like, it's sort of being passed to them as a torch. Save us, Captain America. Mm. Save us, Thor. right? I mean, that's kind of what we're looking for, I think. And this is why I don't think it's a fad. I really don't think it's a fad. I honestly believe that the kind of myth-making that we're seeing now capture the imagination of the globe, that kind of myth-making is going to have seismic consequences. I think it's going to change the way that we tell stories, whether they have to do with superheroes or not.
How are they going to change the way we tell stories? You mean?
Well, I think first and foremost, you started this by saying, and I got this, but you said that Thanos was the protagonist.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I mean, minds were just blown when you said that. But let's think about it for a minute here. This is a man who is confronting the single greatest existential threat that we are all facing, right? Forget about anything else. Trump, fascism, all that. There is only one threat that matters, and that is overpopulation and the destruction of the ecosystem of this planet. And he's got a pretty good answer for it.
Well,
temporarily.
You know, I mean, a workable answer for it, right? But it's the kind of answer that God would do, right? God is sitting up on his throne. He's so annoyed with all the noise that's happening down here.
Get two of every
and he's
animal.
Like, yeah, you know what? I'm just going to fucking kill all of you because you're too noisy and annoying.
Yeah.
And then who saves the day? The man, right? The one guy who sort of, in a way, takes on this kind of superhero outfit. It's an old story.
Yeah.
But it's one that I think is being remade and refashioned based on, you know, what it is that we need right now.
Yeah.
Right. You got to take this. The Bible's
the original IP.
Yeah.
We got to get the rights to that thing.
We got to get the rights to the Bible.
I'm going to prove this. Okay. We're going to play a little game.
Okay.
Okay, this is a little game that I like to call God or superhero. God or superhero.
Sure.
Yes.
We used to play as a camp.
You had a lot of Catholic experiences. Right. This is a common game for you. So this is how it's going to work. It's kind of like Jeopardy rules. So I'll describe something. Mm-hmm. I'll describe a being to you, and all you have to do is tell me God or superhero.
Are we a team or are we competing?
You're competing.
Oh, good.
Great.
You're competing. I actually have a pencil. I'm going to write this down. Right. Here we go.
But God is a superhero. Mm.
That's what I've been saying. Mm. Okay. All right. Okay. Number one. Nicknamed the Mighty, this powerful being wields lightning, wind, and rain as weapons with which to defeat enemies. Has a particular hatred of snakes. God or superhero? Chris?
I'm going to go with God on that one.
Okay.
Yeah, I think God too.
God, yes, you're right. God. Baal.
Oh, Baal.
Baal, very, very popular Canaanite deity in his time.
Yeah, I remember
the tales
of Baal.
Baal, yeah,
is
good
Baal
guy.
In Indiana Jones, actually?
Okay.
might be.
Number two. Both omniscient and omnipresent, meaning he can be anywhere and everywhere at once.
You don't have to describe
I don't know how you're educating. You went to UC Davis. No. I don't know. Wow. I'm not sure, you know.
They're watching.
All right, here we go. Both omniscient and omnipresent, which you apparently know what that means, this being is perhaps best known for creating an entire world from scratch. God or superhero?
You want me to say God.
I'm going to say superhero.
You don't know what I want.
Yeah, I'll say superhero.
You said superhero?
Yeah.
Correct. I'm speaking of Dr. Manhattan.
Yes.
That's right.
Yes.
Legendary Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons, 1986 creation, Dr. Manhattan. That's right. Okay. Number three. A reanimated skeleton wearing a tuxedo, top hat, and sunglasses, whose favorite pastimes include drinking rum, smoking cigars, chasing women, and swearing profusely. God or superhero?
God.
This feels like a god and
yeah, yes, he's like a voodoo.
Nice!
Yeah.
Yes, Baron Samedi.
Yes,
that's right.
Indeed.
Yes, the spirit of the dead, or Loa, as they say in Haitian voodoo. Well done. Damn. Okay. Number four. Known simply as him.
by his many worshippers. Mm-hmm. This being is perhaps most famous for having died and risen from the dead. God or superhero?
This actually sounds familiar, and I want to say superhero.
Just think about what your Catholic
I'll just
educators.
Go God. Fine, I'll go God.
No, it's superhero. It's Adam Warlock. Adam
yes.
Warlock.
Yes.
Him? Stan Lee, Jack Kirby, 1967. Whew. Adam Warlock.
He's
he dies and
times.
Comes from the dead. He does it a couple of times.
They all do.
It's true. Yeah, that was okay. All right, last one. Immortal being who oscillates between creation and destruction can appear in multiple forms. Powers include omniscience, invisibility, super strength, known for a volatile temper that has led him on multiple occasions to nearly wipe out all of humanity. God or superhero?
I mean, come on.
Super God.
I'll say superhero.
I'm going to go with God on that one.
Literally God, that's right.
Oh, actual God. Yeah, fine, actual God.
God.
Yeah, fine, actual God.
God, that's yeah. right, yes. Yeah. Yeah. I think I made my point. I think I've made it that's pretty right. clearly. Thank you. All right, so we always end our shows here with something that we call the five questions. These are just kind of, you know, rapid fire questions. I'll ask you each, and each of you guys give me an answer. It's very simple, very simple. All right, here we go. Let's start with you, Steve. What's your favorite book?
I guess I'll say The Sun Also Rises. I went through a Hemingway phase really as a young man. And I think a lot of writers, probably white male writers, sort of look at him and go, that's a proper writer.
Yeah.
And I have since, you know, sort of moved away from that, but I read it a lot and I taught it, I think, at one point.
How old were you when you first?
It's probably a high school book.
High school, yeah.
Yeah, so it must have been like 15 or something.
Nice. Yeah. Chris, favorite book?
But this, it splits down very cleanly. I vacillate between various books by F. Scott Fitzgerald. His short stories have been recompiled and compiled. There's a one goes by the name Diamond as Big as the Ritz, but it's a book of short stories. It's absolutely lovely.
Excellent. We talked a little bit about your collaborative writing process, but what's your individual writing
sure.
process? What's your writing process?
I mostly treat it like a job, so that it's get up early, do everything I need to do, try to get my ass in the chair by 8:30 or so, and I'm having the one cup of coffee, then I'm probably looking over the pages I did before. And shining them up, and then I am writing whatever I assigned to myself that day, and that means that I have on the board a little list of the days of the week, and it says do scenes 2, 3, and 4 right. on Monday, do 5 yeah, on the, and yes. then when I'm done, I'm done. So that means I could be done at noon, or I could be done at 4, but you know, I try not to stay there all day.
Right. Yeah. Chris, writing process.
I am wasting so much time. I'm drinking a debilitating amount of coffee.
Yeah.
I am going, looking at the schedule and looking at the calendar and going, I got time. I got time. But the anxiety is building up and I'm feeling worse and worse and worse about all the time that I'm not using writing. Then you get to the last day, I freak out. I do the writing. It doesn't take that long. And I go like, why the fuck didn't I do this at the beginning of the week? It would have felt so much better the rest right. of the time.
Yeah.
And then I hand it in and it starts again.
That sounds familiar.
Awful.
Yeah. Let's start with you, Chris, this time. If you weren't a writer, what would you be?
Rotting in the ground.
Yeah.
Shoveling snow, probably, because I would have had to, I'm from Buffalo, I would have had to move back. Oh. I couldn't have kept up the LA lifestyle yeah. with, you know, and then you do what, delivering pizza, be that weird 50-year-old guy
that's
driving
a legit
up in a Honda
job
Civic.
In you know, Buffalo.
It is a legit job anywhere because the pizza's not going to drive itself. But, yeah, something like that.
Right. Steve, if you weren't a writer, what would you be?
Probably an English teacher of some kind.
Chris, what's the worst writing advice you've ever gotten?
I am, it's such bad advice that I am so incredibly grateful to the person who said it, because it came out of his mouth in the phrase I'm about to say. In the next draft, I want you to fully implement the Police Academy template.
It's what I was gonna say.
I know, that's why I went first. Because it's extraordinary.
I don't think that sentence has ever been spoken.
We just sat there and went, yeah. Okay,
we'll do that.
Got it.
Yeah.
Were you gonna say the same thing?
I was, but I gave this little.
I mean, you can't beat that.
No, it's tough.
Yeah. Thank you, sir.
That wins.
You may know who you are. I don't know if you do.
Stephen, what is the best writing advice you can give, particularly to, you know, a young, struggling writer, someone who's just kind of starting out or emerging? Hmm. Best writing advice.
I'll say the advice I kind of wish I had 10 years ago. So it's not necessarily the best for every particular writer starting out. I could have used, don't equate anxiety with work.
Tell me more about that.
I really, really felt that the more I was thinking about the work, the more that I was stressing about the work, the more I brought the work home with me,
meant that
I was treating it with the import that it required, you know, because damn it, I moved to LA only to do this. Mm-hmm. And it's, I'm still not great at it, but I'm getting better at it. And I realized that you can separate church and state much better and do both better.
That's good advice. Mm-hmm. Chris?
Don't show anybody the first draft. Maybe don't show anybody the second draft. It gets better with every single draft, and you're never done. And if you don't have anybody to show it to, rewrite it again.
Right.
And this is also advice I would like to give to producers, because they read a first draft and they freak out. And it's like, well, you fundamentally don't understand the nature of writing if you're freaking out about a first draft. It's just, you know, it's like going, like, we put up all the wood that's on the inside of your house, and next time we're going to actually put the walls on. And the person comes and goes like, it doesn't have any fucking walls. And it's like, yeah, because it's a first draft.
Mm-hmm. Keep it to yourself.
Yeah. So I want everybody to understand that on both sides of the process.
So final question here. You know, after this massive success that you guys have had, like what's next? I mean, is there a desire to kind of do something small, quiet, dark, maybe the origin story of some popular villain that becomes a festival darling? I don't know. Like, any, what's
Thanos the early years?
What's next for you guys?
We started a studio with the Russo brothers, who had directed our last four films. And so we were producing more, and we're also writing for this studio. And so the first thing that we wrote is the Cambridge Analytica story. So our hope is to film that next year.
You were looking for someone more villainous than Thanos.
Yes.
We liked, it's a true complicated story that not everyone understands yet. And we think it's important. And we, on our resume are a lot of weird little true stories. We just sort of lately found ourselves in the cultural zeitgeist for superheroes and killing God, obviously.
We weren't killing God, we were creating new ones. If you stop downplaying this, you could have a comfortable position highly placed in the new church.
No, the only true Messiah is the one who denies he's the Messiah.
Oh, snap.
There you go.
Where's your Messiah now?
Where's your Messiah now? I can't thank you guys enough. Ladies and gentlemen, Chris Marcus and Stephen McFeely. That was a great conversation. Thank you so much to my guests, Christopher Marcus and Stephen McFeely. They are the writers of a very small movie called Avengers Endgame, and maybe you guys can help them out, see if you can maybe find that movie somewhere. I'm sure you could possibly find it online. You know, help them out and watch the movie. They certainly could use the money, I think.
Rough Draft is a Topic original series hosted by me, Reza Aslan. Executive produced by Reza Aslan, David Andreoni, Alfredo De Villa, and Safa Samizadeh Yazd. Executive producers for Topic are Ryan Chametry, Anna Holmes, and Gina Constantinakos, with production aid from Russell Sperberg. Our music and theme is by Jacob Snyder, sound by Sean Oakley, editing and mixing by Will Stanton, with additional editing by Blake V. You can follow Rough Draft on Twitter at Rough Draft Reza, on Facebook at Rough Draft with Reza Aslan, or you can email us at roughdraftpodcast@topic.com. You can also follow me, Reza Aslan, at Reza Aslan. For transcripts and a list of full credits, go to topic.com/rdpodcast. If you love this interview, be sure to check out our TV show, as well as Topic's original series and exclusive programming from around the world. Try it for free on the Apple TV app, already on your favorite devices. You can watch Topic at home or on the go with offline viewing, and you can also share your subscription between up to 6 family members with family sharing. That's what I do. Just go to apple.co/topic, that's apple.co/topic, to start your 7-day free trial now. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time on Rough Draft.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.